Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Every Thursday is the day that I bring to you guests who will walk us through new learning, expanded learning, new conversations that will hopefully challenge us to think more broadly, more wisely, more thoughtfully. Today's guest is no different. I am very pleased to introduce you to Darlene Lancer, who is the author, among many other things, who is the author of Dealing with a Narcissist. Darlene is a marriage and family therapist. She coaches internationally. She's got many years' experience working with couples and individuals. She is also a specialist in dealing with relationships. Darlene, you wear many, many hats. You do many, many things. Welcome to Mind Talk. I'm very pleased to welcome you back to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure talking to your audience, and I think you're a fantastic host, and I'm very grateful to be invited back.
And folks, I didn't pay her to say that. Darlene, among the many things that you have written is something entitled Dealing with a Narcissist. And I'd like to start with, what exactly is your definition of a narcissist? And then I want to talk to you about the subtitle on your book, which I think is very interesting as well. But, you know, we hear the word narcissist so many times today. Everybody's a narcissist according to everybody else. What exactly is a narcissistic personality?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that because people love to call anyone who they think likes attention or they deem to be selfish as a narcissist. We all have narcissistic traits. In fact, there's such a thing as healthy narcissism too, which I can go into more if you like. But I'm focusing on, it's called NPD, Narcissistic Personality Disorder. And it's actually pretty rare. It's estimated 1 to 6% of the population. Males account for 50 to 75%. Usually it's like 3 to 1 males to females. Mm. But recently the 6% top end of the percent has been challenged because a lot of those research studies were done with college students who tend to be more self-centered anyway.
Okay.
So when they do them with older adults, the percentage goes down. But basically, there's three core symptoms, and you need 5 of 9 symptoms in the diagnostic manual to qualify for NPD. But the three basic ones are lack of empathy, needing admiration from others, and grandiose sense of who they are. But sometimes that's just expressed in their fantasy. It doesn't have to be boasted about or bragged about. And there's other characteristics that they must have. They have to have 2 more. In addition to those two of the following. Either they exploit and take advantage of other people to achieve their personal needs. They're very envious of others and think other people are envying them. They may be very arrogant and act that way. Or they believe that they're somehow special and unique, and they can only be understood by or want to associate with other high-status people or institutions.
So when you describe the narcissist, as you just have, it really kind of sounds like it could attach to anyone really who's in the public eye and wants to be there.
Well, not necessarily so, because there are many people in the public eye, Oprah, for one, who is empathic, and that's
okay.
A core symptom that they lack.
Okay.
And Andy Grove, who is a leader of Intel, and he's very wide known as a very successful CEO, and he's not a narcissist. So there's George Soros. There's many people who are very successful and strong, independent. They have clear boundaries. They're very direct. They might even like the limelight, but that doesn't make them a narcissist.
Okay, so it sounds like the takeaway from this part of our conversation is that people too quickly refer to others as narcissists, quite frankly, without really having an understanding of what the concept is, what it means, what it looks like in day-to-day living.
That's true. And even I've heard of some stars, Kardashian, for instance, who love to take selfies and take pictures of themselves. Well, that alone, that's only one trait. So you have to have five of these. There's nine that are listed. I've summarized them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have five of those to qualify for narcissistic personality disorder. And someone who has the traits I described, for instance, who's a strong leader and maybe likes the public eye, that could also qualify as healthy narcissism, because narcissism exists on a scale from very immature to very healthy narcissism. And the far end, people have very low self-esteem and they want to hide.
So, in fact, it's not the dirty word that typically people intend it to be when they use it.
Well, that's correct. Actually, Freud talked about narcissism as a state of development of a infant when it doesn't see its parents, its mother, as an other person. The infant doesn't have those kinds of boundaries. They're fused. And it's not until the Oedipal age, around 5 or 6, that they start being capable of a mutual, reciprocal relationship. The problem is, for someone with NPD, they never go beyond that.
Gotcha.
So in some ways, you could think of it as immature narcissism, or archaic, they call it primary narcissism, where they never really mature. They get stuck at that developmental stage. And it's not because they want to be mean necessarily. They're just incapacitated.
They're just stuck for whatever
right.
reason. Let me ask you about the subtitle to your book, which I did not share earlier. It is 8 Steps to Raise Self-Esteem and Set Boundaries with Difficult People. What is the connection between self-esteem, setting boundaries, and dealing with a narcissist?
That is a great question, and that's what sets you apart as a hostess of these shows. No one has asked me that. And it's because people who are either raised by a narcissist or closely involved with someone, even if it's your boss, if you are connected with them for long periods of time, it's very damaging to your self-esteem. And you don't get your needs met. You're put down often and shamed. And I can go into why that happens. So by the time you've been around a narcissist for some time, your self-esteem, if you had some before, is at a low point. And then it becomes very hard to set boundaries with them because they don't like hearing no. It's my way or the highway is the narcissist's motto. And so it's very difficult. They intimidate you. They blame you, attack you. They maybe rage. And so someone close to them backs off, and they don't set boundaries, which is the worst way to deal with it.
The worst way to deal with a narcissistic person is in not setting boundaries.
Well, you invite more abuse.
And in fact, it would be one of the hardest things to do if you're really in a place where you feel as though you have to deal with this narcissistic person.
You got it. Yeah.
Let me ask you, forgive me for interrupting myself, but you made the comment that more men are identified as narcissistic than women. Any sense as to what that's about?
I don't know why. I have some guess in that it may be the way we evaluate or take tests of people, because a woman's narcissist may not be so overt, like a celebrity, for instance. It might be that she thinks she's the best mother. It might not have anything to do with being in the public eye. And there's different types of people. Oh, men tend to, because of our culture and biology, I think also, they tend to seek naturally to be more autonomous. And when you go into the formation of the character of the narcissist, they look for power as a way to protect themselves, whereas women will more frequently gravitate towards pleasing and idealizing love in order to be loved and feel safe. So I would say just naturally men will be more inclined to seek power as a way to feel safe in a family, and because they're just naturally more aggressive because of hormones and everything. So that may be one reason that it's easier. And then there's a type of narcissism called covert narcissism. And it doesn't look like narcissism. The person may seem like a do-gooder, but they also always think like they're never appreciated. They feel like victims. They might not brag at all. They may do the opposite. But underneath, they feel like they're entitled to special treatment and the world owes them. So it's not as overt. It's more hidden. In fact, it's been called a closet narcissist. So I think a lot of times those don't get weeded out when people do research and things like that.
And, you know, the other thing that I think about it as I'm listening to your observations is that it seems like men, boys, are in some ways steered towards what could on the outside look like a narcissistic stance in the world. Because boy, not as much as before, but boys really are very often taught, it seems to me, to see themselves as separate and above and apart and better, or at least they need to be better. Whereas, as you said, girls are really kind of socialized in a different way. If, in fact, one is grows up in a house with a narcissistic parent, are you guaranteed to be a narcissistic person yourself?
No, not at all. I mean, there are many families. Now, there is research now that's showing that there seems to be a genetic predisposition for it. They've done twin studies. But I know of many families, including my own, where you might have a narcissistic parent, but only one of the children is a narcissist. Or some are, some aren't. So it doesn't necessarily follow. But you will be codependent. I'll just put that in the mix.
You will be codependent. Say more about that.
Okay. In my opinion, narcissists are codependent. I'm probably in the minority because most people say, well, a codependent gets involved with a narcissist. But if you look at the psychodynamics underneath, it's very similar. They both share shame. They both have dysfunctional boundaries, dysfunctional communication. They both suffer from denial. They both tend to be dependent. So even though a narcissist may look very independent and wants to protect their independence and claim their independence at all times, if they're married to someone, they don't want to be left. And that's when you can get their attention, actually. If you're serious about leaving, they will try to keep you. They'll turn on the charm or the hate, one or the other, to try to get you to stay because they don't want to be abandoned. There's a lot of abandonment underneath, too.
So they're both, it sounds like they're both very other-focused, the codependent person and the narcissist. Okay.
Yeah, you got it, because narcissists are very dependent on other people's opinion. And that's part of my definition of codependence, is that your thoughts and your behavior revolves around someone or something outside of yourself.
You've talked about the covert or the closet narcissist, but you also talk about the malignant narcissist. What is that? Sounds kind of scary.
Yes, they have more sociopathic traits. They're very hostile. They have more antisocial behavior. Generally, many narcissists, again, not all, but some feel like they're above the law and morality and the law doesn't apply to them. But then some will actually have no qualms about intentionally breaking the law to get what they want. And they may actually sadistically harm people. So they're much more hostile. And if you're with a narcissist and they're exhibiting this kind of behavior and you feel that you're at harm, I would really suggest thinking about taking steps to protect yourself and leave, because this type of narcissist is not as amenable to treatment and reform.
Once a narcissist, always a narcissist, or is there the potential for change?
There is a potential for change, and I go through in my book some criteria to look for. One of them is if they can take responsibility for their behavior. Many narcissists just will blame you or blame someone else. Their favorite defense mechanism is projection, which can be very hard to live with if you don't have a secure sense of self. If you're codependent, you start to believe whatever they throw your way. And really what they're doing is telling you how they think about themselves inside. It's like a bully who's insecure and then belittles other people. So, but if they can take responsibility for themselves, if they're willing to enter treatment, if they're not a frequent liar and exhibiting this sociopathic behavior, then there is hope for that, for change. Most narcissists don't want to enter counseling because then they face with looking at themselves, and anything that tarnishes their image, they will run away from. And it sounds like it's because, well, they're so arrogant and conceited, but it's really because they're so fragile.
Mm.
They really have to work very hard at maintaining their image because they feel crushed. There's so much shame underneath. And people dislike narcissists, but it's really very sad.
It is sad when you think about it. And as you were talking about a narcissist entering treatment, you know, my thought was, well, that would be really, really hard and scary for a narcissist to do. There'd need to be a lot of work to get him or her into a place where he could even tolerate beginning to look at self.
That's right. I mean, one narcissist told me that he had to quit therapy because he needed to drink to get through the session because his self-esteem was being ruined.
How do you get a sense? What's a beginning way to look at, if you will, what's going on in a relationship so that you can get a sense of whether or not you might be in the cycle of a narcissistic relationship?
Well, often when people get involved with a narcissist, they're taken by their charm, and the narcissist can be very persuasive and seductive because they want to draw people in who will admire them. And some research showed, and a lot of people say, oh, I feel like so stupid, you know, after a while when things change, they think they really are very judgmental of themselves that they got taken in. However, they did some research and they had people talk to, interview different people for about several different sessions, spending 20 minutes with each person. And it turned out that the people couldn't spot the narcissist. They liked them until after 7 visits. And then they started to see what the person was really like. And then their opinion changed. So narcissists will do this, and then you become hooked, you become dependent, and then after a while, they'll start finding fault with you. This is a very typical trait. That doesn't make a person a narcissist. Codependents do this too, but they'll start finding fault with you. But more importantly, when it comes to your needs, they have no interest in meeting your needs. Things have to revolve around their schedule, their timing, what they want. And little by little, they might start to denigrate you and maybe try to change you into being who they want. And then the relationship starts to deteriorate. They put more and more demands on you. And then, not always, but some narcissists then will look for someone else because they've found your flaws and the romance is waning, and so now they won't need someone else to fill what they call, what's called their narcissistic supply. They're very hungry because they're very empty inside and they constantly need from you. Now, if it's a woman, she might need constant flattery and constant attention. And you can also tell by how they treat other people. If they're rude to waitresses, for instance, if they have to have the best seats and the best clothes and only go to the best doctors, for instance, hang out with famous people, that's a sign of their insecurity in that they, the appearance is very important. So appearances might be very important to them. If they think other people are envying them, and they're envying others about what they don't have. So you look for some of these traits. Another one that can be very irritating is a sense of entitlement. You know, that they are special and they need to come first, and they get are very intolerant when they don't get their way or they don't get their special treatment. So those are some things, and but the key is then lack of empathy. So they don't care about when you're tired, when you're hungry, when you're in pain. They can be very dismissive. And they may even belittle your sad feelings, fearful feelings, because to them it's intolerable.
I see.
They always have to be invincible, self-sufficient. Asking a narcissist to show their feelings, and like a lot of partners, particularly women, want their male partners to show more feelings, that's, they think of that as disdain. They're going to like go in the opposite direction. And sometimes they may be distancers in a relationship because they don't want to get too close. Or the sex may be fantastic, but there's no emotional connection. And you keep like hoping and pursuing them and wanting more connection, but they put up obstacles or roadblocks, and they're maybe just interested in sex but not really relating on an emotional level. And this could go on in a marriage even after you get married to them. So if you get them to marry you, you may have won the booby prize.
It sounds like the first thing you need to do is to date anybody you're going to date. You need to date them for at least 7 dates before you make any decisions about what you're going to do next.
Right, and see how they resolve conflict. I always say that's important, you see, because people are on their best behavior. Well, how do they behave when they're angry?
Right.
Or you can't agree how, and that's very important in a long-term relationship, is being able to resolve conflict.
You talk about the fragility of the narcissistic person, which I completely agree with you. Most people don't see, don't think about. It just sort of doesn't equate. You also talk, though, about the many ways in which a narcissist will attempt to secure his or her own power. And one of the examples that you give, I mean, you talk about abuse, but you also talk about the non-physical forms of abuse that can show up often in a relationship with a narcissistic person. Can you give us a sense of what some of that non-physical abuse would look like?
Withholding. would be a key one, especially if it's withholding intimacy. I know people who's, now this doesn't make a person a narcissist, because other people do this too, but one example would be not speaking to their partner for a few days. So that's punishment. Withholding money if they control the money, withholding affection. So those are some examples.
Let's say that we've got some folks listening now and they're starting to get a little bit concerned that they might be in a relationship with the kind of person that you and I are talking about. And they've got children, and they've got family history. And yes, they're exhausted in the relationship, but is there a way for them to really begin to save themselves? I think there is. I think it's in your subtitle. But let's talk about that.
Yes, I'm glad you asked, because I've actually worked with people and who have improved their relationships. Either I see them personally or I do phone coaching. And actually, I'm thinking of a few situations where I thought the relationship was hopeless. I thought the spouse was so abusive that I would be helping this person leave. But to my amazement, by setting boundaries and by this person overcoming their own shame and not feeling like taking everything in and as truth about themselves, because they had their own script of shame going to begin with, that they were able to turn the relationship around.
Interesting.
And actually, excuse me, they told me that they were happier than when they first got married.
Oh, that really is interesting. And it also speaks to a lot of hope for the potential change, you know, within the human spirit. A lot of times folks feel like they're stuck, and perhaps they're not as stuck as they think.
Mm-hmm. Now, you may not be able, as someone who really has NPD, and by the way, a lot of people maybe, we call it subclinical, maybe they have four of the five traits, so they're not 100% a narcissist. And even if they have them, they could be mild, because traits exist on a continuum. So I know narcissists that are very warm, very caring people, very conscientious, they're introspective, and they don't go around bashing and hurting people. Sometimes their partners could be frustrated with them, but you may not be able to change a person's ability to empathize. However, narcissists can be taught, and this is what I go into in my book, to change their behavior. So they can learn to meet some of your needs, even if it isn't because they understand and care about you getting your needs met, but they can change their behavior so the relationship works better.
So
you follow what I mean,
you're getting your needs met because of the change. They're getting their needs met to keep you because of the change.
Precisely. And that's, I go into scripts and exactly how to approach confronting. I said, and you pointed out, that the hardest thing to do is to set boundaries with a narcissist, but there's ways to do it that instead of being aggressive about it, that are educative, and you're teaching a narcissist. And actually, one of the clues that you might be dealing with a narcissist is that sometimes you wonder if their empathy is feigned, or are they really sincere. You're kind of never sure if it's an act or not. And your gut is probably right, because many narcissists have learned how to be socially and how to be appropriate, and they expect others to be socially appropriate, and they work very hard at it. So they may seem very loving, but it's really not connecting to something deeper. But it can feel really good, especially if you're very needy of affirmation and you want to hear this, and it can make you fall in love with someone like that. And then later, you find out, well, it was just an act.
And it wasn't so much love as it was your need.
Well, yeah, or their need to be, you know, the narcissist need to be accepted and
right.
draw someone in, and your need to be admired and to be charmed, to be in a relationship. And there's people that, again, that don't fully reach the level of NPD, and research has shown that they can be taught empathy. So this is someone who's, again, subclinical, that by example, and they're through imagination, they're taught, well, now if you're, what if you were in that person's shoes, and then they have an aha experience, they can connect the dots if they think it through.
Interesting. So again, what I'm hearing is while dealing with a narcissist, being a narcissist, it can be its own set of challenges, there is hope. And I think that's so important because, you know, lots of times people have a tendency to think in a very black and white way about relationships and what's going to work and what's not going to work. You talk about, as you go through the steps to improving one's own self-esteem and setting boundaries, you raise the concept of detaching with love. And for many people, the idea of detaching and love just does not belong in the same concept, in the same sentence. What do you mean when you say detach with love?
Yes, that's a common phrase in Al-Anon, 12-step program, CODA, Codependency Anonymous, because they're so wrapped up in the other person. And like a jumpy rabbit, they're reacting to every word and everything that their partner does and taking everything personal. There's another saying, Q-tip, quit taking it personally. So detaching with love means you detach from the person's behavior and you don't personalize it. It doesn't mean you don't love them, and it doesn't mean that you leave them. In fact, you can react as much when you're 3,000 miles away as when you're, you know, right next to the person. So it's an internal emotional shift where you're seeing the person as separate from yourself. There's less, there's more boundaries. You can look at it that way. You're getting healthier boundaries. You see that person, their feelings, their needs, their wants, their behavior is not a reflection on you. And this is a problem for codependents in general, both narcissists and their partners. So, and then I have a caveat that you don't want to empathize so much that you forgive everything and you forget about abuse. Then you're lacking empathy with yourself, self-compassion. So it's just enough so you don't take personally and you get your mind off of the other person. You start investing in yourself and building your own self-esteem. And for anyone, again, who's interested, on my website, there's a free handout, 14 Tips for Letting Go.
Oh, wonderful.
If you sign my mailing list. So.
And, you know, while we're at that, let's just have your website again.
It's What Is Codependency, all one word, no hyphens, .com.
Okay. We are talking about, we've just begun to talk about ways in which to really focus on building yourself up rather than allow yourself to be torn down in the service of someone else's unhealthy needs. When we come back, I'd like to, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk more about what exactly goes into building up self-esteem. You know, it's one of, we hear it all the time, you know, take care of yourself, build up your self-esteem. Your self-esteem isn't high enough. And of course, the common question is, well, how do I do that? And people just aren't clear about what building up one's self-esteem means, number one. And for many people, the idea of building up their own self-esteem somehow gets attached to it that they've got to be mean to other people, which is not at all what it means. So we've got a lot more to discuss, but we're going to focus on ways in which to build your self-esteem when we come back, which will be in just a moment. My name is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk. I am having a conversation with the author of Dealing with a Narcissist, 8 Steps to Raise Self-Esteem and Set Boundaries with Difficult People. This is marriage and family counselor Darlene Lancer. She's a relationship coach. She does telephone coaching. She does a little bit of everything. We'll be right back and continue our conversation with Darlene Lancer.
This is listener-supported radio, WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C.
Darlene, let's talk about ways to build self-esteem, not only if you're in a relationship with a narcissistic individual, but because your own self-esteem is sort of your foundation that keeps you afloat throughout your own life. How do you approach that?
Well, the first thing is paying attention to how you talk to yourself. Most people are not aware that inside they have a harsh inner critic. They're just not very mindful of their self-talk. And I have a little YouTube up where I say you can wear a rubber band and just start snapping it every time you say, I should do this, I should have done that. All this self-judgment, call yourself names, pushing yourself. So start paying attention to your self-talk. And I wrote a little ebook, 10 Steps to Self-Esteem, which I outline 10 steps of overcoming this and changing your self-talk. You can do a week at a time. And then you want to change it, your critic, into a positive coach instead of a negative critic. Now, and the other thing is about learning to express yourself. People with self-esteem are not afraid to be themselves, to express their opinion, to be honest. Most codependents will hide the truth. They'll say what someone else wants to hear. They'll hide negative thoughts and feelings if they're afraid that it'll jeopardize a relationship. And they go along. They'll say yes when they want to say no. So being assertive is a key way to build self-esteem. In fact, self-esteem and assertiveness are both learned. That means that non-assertiveness is learned and low self-esteem is learned. So you can change that by learning healthier ways to communicate and healthier ways to treat yourself. And raising your self-esteem will improve your communication. Becoming more assertive will raise your self-esteem. So they're interrelated. So setting boundaries with people, learning to be clear about how you communicate will help your self-esteem. In fact, when you meet someone, you can tell something about their self-esteem just by the way they talk. If they're vague, if they're indirect, that's a sign of low self-esteem. Another thing is keeping commitments to yourself and meeting your needs. Typically, codependents will keep commitments to other people, but then they complain that other people abandon them, but then they abandon themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't keep commitments they've made to themselves. They're not aware of their needs. This is part of the denial I mentioned. So they may judge their feelings or think they should get over some feelings or they shouldn't be angry. Again, a lot of self-judgment. They don't take care of themselves in many ways. So meeting your needs rather than expecting someone else to meet them is key. These are all ways to build autonomy. which builds your self-esteem.
For the person who's thinking that self-esteem is just kind of something that they're stuck with, they either have it or they don't, and they're now, let's say, 20 years old, 50 years old, 80 years old, and you hear, I've been like this all my life, I can't change, what's the point? I mean, clearly there's some self-esteem stuff in there, but as you talk about growing your own self-esteem, you're saying, number one, you can, and number two, it's if you do it with deliberateness, it's a relatively straightforward path. Do you say that to everyone? Does it matter what age you are when you stop to think about changing your own sense of yourself or questioning your self-esteem?
No, age doesn't matter, but you know, it's like building muscles. And I've talked to trainers who said they've helped, you know, 80-year-old women put on muscle mass by lifting weights. So it takes practice, whether you're young or whether you're old. Now, a lot of this dysfunctional behavior is just bad habits. And we all know habits are hard to change. So it takes reinforcement. So I always say, if you go to a 12-step program, you know, you're going to hear more feedback if you're working with a coach or a therapist. If you're reading books every day, you want to keep inundating yourself with a new perspective. So it does take some work, but you can, throughout the day, you have multiple opportunities to build your self-esteem in how you're thinking, in every choice you make, and how you spend your time, how you speak. You can affirm, you have a choice every moment whether to affirm yourself or whether to abandon yourself. I actually wrote a blog on affirming your authentic self, and that's a way to build self-esteem. And I talk about how moment to moment, really, you know, whether you're overworking, or you're getting enough sleep, are you eating healthy, are you being honest in your communication with people? So these are all ways with you, are you validating yourself or are you abandoning yourself?
Well, just the comment that you made a moment ago that in every moment you have the potential for making a choice, that all by itself I think is such a powerful concept that you really can make a choice in every single moment, and that choice is really up to you.
True. I mean, the first step, though, is being aware of what's going on. So until you need some education, some information, to find out, you know, start to identify some of your negative habits or self-destructive habits or self-destructive thoughts, and being able to see the right path versus a self-destructive path, so you gain some objectivity. And that's one of the advantages of starting to become more aware of this inner critic, and it can be very painful in the beginning. People have no idea sometimes how, and then they wonder why they're depressed, but they're living with an abuser themselves.
At themselves, right.
Yeah, and then there's a period where people feel kind of overwhelmed. They see this negative, and they think, oh my God, I didn't realize how much work I have to do. But that's just part of the process until you start to come out the other side.
And again, it speaks to the need to take a look at your self-talk, because if you tell yourself you've got so much work to do, it's very easy for you to sit still and do nothing because you overwhelm yourself rather than saying, I can do this little piece right now and then I'll see what I do next.
It's very easy to fall into hopelessness. And, you know, I was raised with the belief that there's a saying, like, as I don't know, I'll paraphrase it, but something like, as you are at seven, you're the same at 70. So I had this script, because I heard it in my family, that you can't change. And then over 35 years ago, I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and I was very inspired hearing people had changed. It was like miraculous to me. So that's also one of the benefits of going to a 12-step program, that you hear other people's stories and how they turn their life around. Even going to an AA meeting, if you're not an alcoholic, it's very inspirational, because you hear people that have, they were in prison, you know, or maybe not, maybe they just lost everything, and now they're totally different people. And there are many examples, actually, well-known examples of people. I mentioned them in my book on self-forgiveness, who have committed crimes and really shameful things, and then became made contributions to society and turned their lives around. It does take work.
It takes work, but, you know, I typically say it's, if it's work that you're doing on yourself, perhaps it's work you deserve to do.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. And I think it takes reminders, because we start to lose, we have setbacks. That's part of change. Change is not a straight uphill line, it's a spiral. I talk about this in my book on codependency. Mm-hmm. Think of a slinky. You know, it's spiraling, but it's spiraling upward. And I lay out the stages of codependency in that book. And there's the beginning, middle, and late stages. And you can either go from the beginning in a downward spiral until you just have a shell of yourself, or at any point you can turn that around and start going uphill, and it's a positive feedback loop. The more positive you have, the more positive things you do, and the more hopeful you are. And it's a positive uphill. And I list the signs of improvement in the beginning, middle, and later stages of recovery. It's got a V shape. Either you're going down or you're going up. And this has been validated by research.
Your book, Dealing with a Narcissist, when you talk about becoming autonomous and paying more attention to yourself, you give very specific suggestions as to what people can do to aid themselves. And one of the things that you talk about is creating a playlist of uplifting or relaxing music. Clearly, music is very powerful in all of our lives.
Well, the one thing about music is it bypasses our frontal lobes, our critical thinking. It just goes right into a more visceral part of us. People say it goes right to the heart. So it can uplift your mood. You put on, pick out some songs that really get you, move you, and then play it in the morning. And get out and do things with other people. You know, there's a song that I really like that just really puts a smile on my face, and it's "You're the First and the Last." What is it? "You're My Only Love" or something like that. You know that song?
I think so. I'm not sure. "You're My Everything." Is that the one?
By Barry White.
Yeah.
Yeah. "You're My Everything," I guess. Yeah. And I just, it really puts a smile on my face. Or there's another one by Gloria Gaynor, "I Will Survive." You know, if you're getting over a breakup or something, you know, put those upbeat songs on. The other thing is to take reasonable risks. My YouTube on recovery from codependency, the one where I have the example of snapping your wrist with a rubber band, there's a diagram there of, it's like building self-esteem in a nutshell. And the first, on the lower left side of the triangle, is getting to know yourself. And it's building your awareness. At the peak of the triangle is taking reasonable risks. So that might be setting a boundary, learning something new, taking a class, whatever it might be for you. A big thing for me once was changing an electrical outlet. I was like, that was really scary to me. I also took a rock climbing class, and at the time I was afraid of climbing and heights. So take reasonable risks, and then what happens is your self-concept changes. You are no longer the person you were before you did that, so now you know something new about yourself. You might take a risk, and it turns out you don't like that, or that was a bad idea. So you also learn more about boundaries. Oh, I need to be more protective with that person. Or maybe, you know, that wasn't a good idea. That's also learning about yourself. So it's not like right or wrong. Well, you know, a lot of times our critic paralyzes us because if we, you know, do something, we're afraid of making a mistake. If we don't do it, then we shame ourselves because we're afraid of doing it, or if it doesn't work out right, well, we shouldn't have done it. So the critic can get you coming and going. But I always say it's just choice and consequence. It's not right or wrong. You're learning. Just like if a baby stopped trying to walk the first time it fell down, it would never walk.
Indeed.
So you're taking baby steps and you're learning by trial and error.
And, you know, there are just so many things that you suggest people do, tiny things that one wouldn't necessarily think about. I mean, you talk about the value of having a warm drink, that a warm drink can actually elevate your mood. You know,
yeah, there is actually research.
That's amazing. It's amazing. I just want to go through a couple of the very concrete things that you offer by way of building self-esteem. You talk about spending time playing with a pet or taking a class or going out alone, going to a movie theater or dinner alone. How does that build one's self-esteem?
Well, it's self-esteem, there's many aspects of it, but one of it is also building skills, building autonomy, knowing that you can do things on your own. It gives you confidence because if you had a narcissistic parent, if you're in a relationship with a narcissist, if you're codependent, there's a tendency to lose confidence and doubt yourself. So, and that builds dependency. You're asking everybody else their opinion, and you can't do things alone. You need a buddy. You can't motivate yourself. So finding out that you can do things, then the next time you start to feel like I can't give up, you can remind yourself, oh, last week I did that, and actually it wasn't so bad. I enjoyed it. I remember shortly after I was married, in the beginning, I would take my son to the park happily by myself. After a few years, when I had my second child, I wouldn't go unless my husband would go with me. I had become so codependent.
Interesting.
And so I had to do work on, you know, undoing that and reclaiming. And before I was married, I traveled to Europe by myself. I did a lot of things. But I was in a dysfunctional relationship, and my self-esteem and confidence and autonomy just shrank into nothing. So taking those steps, definitely. Another small thing is if you're comforting yourself, instead of looking to the narcissist to comfort you, is learning self-compassion to honor your feelings. One thing that can help is wrapping yourself in a blanket or sheet, like swaddling, getting in a fetal position. I mean, go into the feeling rather than saying, I shouldn't feel this way. Most people try to run from the feelings, and the feelings just shadow them, and they can get bigger and bigger because we're not taking care of ourselves. We're not nurturing ourselves.
Darlene, thank you so much for joining us today. We will have to have you back. We will have you back. Thank you again, though, for your time today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk right here on WPFW 89.3 on your FM dial. You can listen to this program again and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional of your choice.
choosing. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. The assistant to the executive producer is Lede Battle. For information about Mind Talk, remember that you can go to myndtalk.org. For more information about WPFW, you can also go to WPFWFM.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And remember, if it's unacceptable, you take care.